ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A confession. A memory. A lie. What if all three could be wrong? Forensic is a new series from All in the Mind, unpacking the hidden psychology of crime solving. Why innocent people confess? How memories can be rewritten? The science behind true crime. All in the Mind, Forensic. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
The global mood may be anxious,
but in Europe, evidently a growing sense of optimism.
Donald Trump's wayward policies have encouraged the Europeans to unite.
So now they're talking about asserting Europeanness. You'll have to explain that to me, Latika.
I'll try to do that for you, Geraldine. But let's just say it's springtime in Prague and Europe is getting on with managing its own affairs. I'm Latika Burke.
And I'm Geraldine Doogue. Welcome to Global Roaming. So you've been at one of Europe's largest security and policy conferences in Prague, GlobSec, Latika. In fact, you've been very busy there. Tell us all about it.
Yes, Geraldine. GlobSec is really the premier security forum for Central and Eastern Europe, unlike Munich, which our listeners would have heard about earlier in the year, which focuses on Western European security and transatlantic alliances. The Central and Europeans really take a deeper interest in Ukraine, I think, also Baltic security and the Balkans. So some very interesting views and perspectives.
Yeah, look, I mean, people who really follow these issues in Europe, of course, do believe that it's this Eastern Europe where the great game is played, you know, the great game of diplomacy, of the balancing of sides, it's often subterranean, but it's so interesting and so multifaceted. And that Western Europe, to that extent, I mean, it's often where the battles are played out, but it's more transparent, that it's here in this area where you are now, where lots of deep-seated attitudes are settled or certainly formed. And I wonder, this sense that you have picked up, that there's a growing optimism, I just wonder how real, like, are there real plans being made?
Yes, Geraldine, I think the Europeans have always tended to approach their foreign policy with perhaps a dose of emotion, and that's not always led them down the right path. That, I think, is really disappearing. And this was the first security conference I've attended where I've just seen across the board pragmatism and hard-headedness, and I think that's something to be really welcomed from Europe.
Well, look, I mean, I hope, obviously, the vocabulary, the verbal way of displaying this is certainly changing. I've got in front of me, and I'm going to recommend to listeners, a very good piece by the European Council on Foreign Relations, From Shield to Sword, Europe's Offensive Strategy in the Hybrid Age. And it's really it's a very good read, but it's certainly, well, it's not saber-rattling in the traditional sense, but it's certainly the language being used is quite interesting. They're saying that Europe has been on the defensive for too long in the information, cyber, finance and kinetic domains. It's now got to go on the offensive, and they've got all sorts of examples of how. And there's this sort of amazing sort of little bit of language. Without this shift, Europe will remain a placid deer amidst a pack of wolves. And, you know, I thought, wow, I wonder how that is actually translating to reality. And that's, I suppose, what you've been trying to assess as well.
Yes, I don't think they're ready to be wolves quite yet, but they're certainly sharpening their teeth, Geraldine.
And look, just before you introduce our guest, the whole business about sort of seriously defending yourself, it is also interesting, the Economist, because, you know, we've got to read about it, just sort of work out who's taking the pulse of these things. The Economist says that senior military people who won't be put their name to any quote, senior European military people, have really in amongst themselves wondered as to whether they'd have to defend themselves from the US. you know, in any really a shakedown with, say, Russia, or if Russia decided to go into Estonia or the Baltic countries, they're not entirely sure anymore, quite extraordinary to be even sort of saying this, that they could trust that the Americans would be on their side. Now, is that sort of thing being said out loud?
I think that is the conversations that you're having privately. I mean, we did know, according to the New York Times reporting, that the Danes were setting up military responses in case the US invaded Greenland. So this is not hypothetical or far-fetched at all. Having said that, I do sense there is a more soothing tone about the US commitment to NATO than we've been hearing. And it was quite interesting to see, as this conference was closing, the Polish were very reassured that Trump had reversed his decision to take 5,000 troops out of Poland. And Radek Sikorski, who's a great personality on the European stage, says,
"We've managed to confuse Putin. He now has no idea what we will do.
We've done it. We've confused Putin. This is strategic confusion. It went down like a treat, but Europe is finding a bit of a groove." But having said that, Geraldine, there are definitely conversations taking place behind closed doors that don't sound like the ones that they have on stage.
Well, look, we thought it was a great opportunity having you there convening various panels to speak with another Australian observer, Dr. Bryce Wakefield. He's CEO of the Australian Institute of International Affairs, that absolutely venerable organisation. I think it's now 72 years old. Now, he has a lot of experience living and working in the US, Japan and Europe. We think it gives him a unique perspective as a sort of political scientist with strong connections to the region, but a real focus on Australia's future. You managed to catch up with him. It'll be terrific to hear how you both wrestle with what really was on display at this GlobSec conference.
Bryce Wakefield, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you very much. Great to be here in Prague.
So what is GlobSec?
So GlobSec is, I think it's the foremost security conference of Central and Eastern Europe. However, like other security conferences around the world, like Munich, like the Shangri-La Dialogue, it does take a broader perspective. There are panels on and guests from places like Africa, but also increasingly the Indo-Pacific, which is a very good thing indeed.
And if we were to take a temperature check, what would you say the state of Europe and how Europe's feeling about its place in the world is right now?
Yeah, well, look, on the public panels, Latika, I found that there was quite a lot of optimism. And in particular, I thought that during a panel with Radek Sikorski, the foreign minister of Poland, and Johann Wadepool, the foreign minister of Germany, both were very upbeat about the future of Europe and what's called the Europeanization of NATO. Now, that's a strange term, I think. It's one that I've heard before, but I really heard it come forth at this conference. It seems to me that Europe is trying to develop itself and seems ready to develop itself as more of a strategic actor that can act independently of the United States.
We've heard since the start of the second Trump administration, I suppose, various emotions from Europe as it's had to deal with what is a very different way that the Trump administration looks at Europe, almost hostile. What is your sense about how Europe is feeling about Trump specifically?
Well, there's still a lot of nervousness and uncertainty, and particularly if you talk to people behind the scenes, that's certainly the case. However, in public, I got the sense that there was an optimism, not just because Europe felt that it was that it could be independent, but there were signs that Europe was managing its own affairs. There's a lot of optimism, for example, around the election in Hungary. And the fact that Europe can chart a course without a constant spoiler amongst its midst in the figure of Viktor Orban. We heard from Anita Orban, I assume it's no relation, talking about how it's possible to beat back what might be seen sometimes as a wave of populism by going directly to the electorate, even if some of these, well, in the case of Orban, a populist leader has been in place and has kind of controlled the institutions of politics in Hungary, it's possible to communicate to the electorate by going straight to them. And there was a lot of hope and inspiration in her speech. And we also heard from Maia Sandu, who, Moldova is not a European nation, but as the president of Moldova, she beat back an election campaign where there was a lot of subversion by Russia. So there were lots of good news stories at this conference.
You brought up the two cases of Anita Orban and Maia Sandu, you know, Hungary and Moldova, because I think this illustrates a really interesting story that's going on inside Europe at the moment and was certainly a discussion, which is enlargement. Moldova and Ukraine want to join the European Union, and Hungary is in the European Union. But one of the big, I think, hesitations behind allowing Ukraine and Moldova, and for that matter, the Western Balkans in, is because of the very backsliding they observed in Hungary and the spoiling role that you pointed out that Viktor Orban was able to play within Europe. So I wonder what you make of this dynamic with inside Europe as an outside observer. Did you sense that Europe is really standing willing, ready and able to open its doors to more countries? Or do you think that Europe's actually a bit scarred by its enlargement process and won't go any further?
In terms of actual practical enlargement, I think there is a limit. And I think, as you say, a lot of people are nervous about the very poor example shown by Ukraine.
Long term, if Europe doesn't let these countries in that are at its door, do you think that's going to be a geostrategic problem for Europe? Because there are certainly parts of the European community that want quicker admission for Moldova and Ukraine. What do you think that means for how Europe long-term positions against Russia?
I think Europe needs to take a hard look at its mechanisms. There was some discussion about revising the voting mechanisms around things like sanctions and things like that, which at the moment all have to be done with consensus. And if you have a spoiler like Hungary in there constantly tearing down funding for Ukraine and things like that, That's not really a sensible way to run an institution with 27 different points of view. So I think Europe does need to have a long, hard look at its institutions and see what needs to be done in order to enlarge in the future. At the moment, I don't think they're quite ready yet.
I'm Latika Berg, speaking with Dr. Bryce Wakefield at the Globsec conference in Prague about a whole range of things. But coming up, what the Europeans get and don't get about the Indo-Pacific. What is your sense of the Indo-Pacific literacy, shall we say? And how have you seen this change, for better or worse, over the time you've been attending these conferences? And we should also add, you go to many of these conferences like Munich, we were both at again this year. So you, I think, have a very good armchair from which to observe Europe's understanding of the Indo-Pacific. How do you think it is?
I think there's certainly curiosity there. And I think the Globsec is a particularly good conference that does invite people from the Indo-Pacific, so they do want to know about it. What I hear about their problems, I mean, there's certainly a lot of There's certainly a lot of anxiousness around, for example, in Germany, the degrading of the German economy, the fact that a lot of the jobs, particularly in those industries that supply the parts to automakers, are just disappearing from the German economy. There's a lot of anxiousness about that. And there's also a lot of anxiousness about securing supply chains. They know that they have a problem, most of the processing of critical raw materials on which their economies rely that the supply chains pass through China. It's a problem that they keep talking about. It's a problem that they keep admiring, but I don't really see any solutions to those problems that are rooted in the Indo-Pacific. One thing I don't see them focusing on, and this is something that the Indo-Pacific speakers keep bringing up, is the fact of strategic competition in our region, and that it's a large part of the story of China's role in the world. If they, and they say they do, see strategic competition as a role for Europe, then they have to become more active in our region. And that happens on a member state basis, I think. I think we do actually see actors sometimes. We might think they're quite random actors like Estonia and Latvia coming down to our region and helping, for example, to build capacity in the and literacy in the South Pacific around cybersecurity and things like that. I think as an entire continent, as a strategic actor, the EU has to become a lot more focused, and hopefully the recent free trade agreement and defence and security agreement that was signed between Australia and the EU can be part of that puzzle.
Yes, so we should also mention that the Taiwanese foreign minister addressed or had a panel. He was completely off the record, which is unusual, but I think that is a growing trend from the Taiwanese, that when they turn up at these things, they're now off the record. They're saying much less in public. But I also heard many, many times how much work the Taiwanese are doing in Ukraine on the ground, learning, acquiring drone capability. So I thought this was a very interesting snippet, and you couldn't walk around this conference hall without running into a Taiwanese person, whether it was someone from defence industry or government. I also found that very interesting because they were not so loud, but the visibility was definitely there if you're face to face with them.
The fact that they're sort of going off record now, I'm not sure what it is, whether it is that they just want to maintain a low profile while they focus on the practicalities. So I do wonder whether domestic politics, where the Czech parliament is more interested in a closer relationship with China, may well be playing into that.
That's really interesting. Was NATO very present and visible? And what is your sense of where the Europeans feel they're at with NATO?
As listeners will know, the United States has declared that it will be withdrawing troops from Germany and shifting troops around. And, you know, Sikorsky made the point that whatever the number that has been cited by the Trump administration, 5,000 troops coming out of Germany, for example, it pales in comparison to the troops already on the ground in Poland, and not to mention Ukraine, of course. There was a sense that it's a period where we can look forward to better times from NATO because the Europeans are willing to stand up. And again, it was signified by this term, the Europeanization of the alliance.
I wonder, from your viewpoint, as someone who you speak two European languages,
I speak three if you include English,
and you also speak Japanese. We should say so. Yeah. I think you have a really unique vantage point to look across these two theatres that we often talk about, the Indo-Pacific and the Euro-Atlantic. What is your advice to governments in each of these jurisdictions about what they need to be learning or doing or collaborating or seeing from each other?
I think that they need to focus a lot more on Southeast Asia, as we do as well, the Australians and the Americans.
And to what end? Are we talking to just do trade, or are we talking far more strategic? What is it that they should be doing?
Well, it's both. And, you know, I think trade is the precursor to effective diplomatic influence, and at the moment we are losing a game where diplomatic influence is being being prosecuted at the in the region by actors we may not like to be so influential, right? Again, I think, as I said, there are actors in the region who we perhaps wouldn't expect, who are getting into South Pacific in a way that helps the South Pacific to resist Chinese interference, for example, and that's altogether a good thing. And I think those are actually quite instructive. The activities of the Latvians and Estonians are very practical measures, and I think the EU needs to look at our region through a very practical lens focused on interests and what these countries need, because in the past, and I sense this is changing, by the way, but in the past there has been a bit too much of a reliance on thinking that Europe will turn up and express its values and those will be respected.
What do you think that the Indo-Pacific and who particularly in the Indo-Pacific should be doing what with Europe?
Well, I think there are a lot of opportunities in not so much the free trade agreement with Europe. Free trade will be free trade. Businesses will take care of that. But in terms of the defence and security agreements, I think there's...
And here you mean Australia, Bryce?
Here I mean Australia in particular. There are opportunities there to cooperate with European firms on procurement in an age where we need to... ensure that every dollar counts in our defence spending. I think it's important that Australians are seen in Europe, not only high-level politicians, at summit meetings and things like that, but I think there's actually a need for Australians to attend these forums as well, so that they can get a better understanding of how Europeans think, but also to put our case on a global forum, because these forums matter. Alexander Stubb referred to specifically Globsec, but other forums as a way of molding public opinion. But he did actually make the criticism that the global South, and I mean, although we're not the global South in the development sense of the term, this applies to Australia as well, that our voices are heard there because a lot of the ideas that are generated at these forums are brought back to national capitals in Europe as well as Brussels, the European capital, and they really do inform policy.
Bryce Wakefield, thank you for joining us on Global Roaming.
Thank you, Latika.
That was Dr. Bryce Wakefield from the Australian Institute of International Affairs with our own Latika Burke. Now, Latika, was anybody from the US there?
Well, that's a great question, Geraldine. This has become a theme of European security forums, aside from Munich, where the Americans turn up and make a great show. We are seeing no Trump admin officials turn up these days. Certainly at Globsec, there was none. At Leonard Mary last week in Estonia, there was one very low-ranking official who absolutely got flamed on his public panel, was openly laughed at, and it was a real car crash appearance. The Trump administration seems to be largely boycotting the security fora, and it's really, really noticed. There were about four or five Americans that showed up this year. They were all retired. It was Mark Esper, the former defense secretary. There was Phil Rieker, who's a veteran retired State Department diplomat who served in Europe, and some of the other well-known figures, Ben Hodges, retired general who commanded troops in Europe. Now, these are stalwarts of these European security fora, so their presence doesn't really signal anything much. The absence of the US in Europe, it does say a lot to these Europeans.
Well, it must. I mean, that is an extraordinary decision, I think. The other question that intrigued me was the Taiwanese story that you and Bryce covered. All this off-the-record business by the Taiwanese. I mean, you were wondering, what's all that about?
Look, I do think it's a bit of a shift that the Taiwanese are turning up and saying less and less in public. I think it shows great concern about how those comments will be read by Beijing. But I do also sense that Taiwan is now firmly a fixture on this particular forum's radar. And I wouldn't say that that's common.
And look, just quickly too, you know, against, like, I'm hearing everything that you say and hearing you and Bryce discuss this, you know, different language, the aspirational tone. And of course, I've got in my background ear Mark Rutte, the head of NATO, basically saying earlier this year and last year, I mean, he never stopped saying it one way and the other.
And if anyone thinks here, again, that the European Union or Europe as a whole can defend itself without the US, keep on dreaming. You can't. We can't. We need each other.
Without the US, forget it. There's no real NATO. You know, come to terms with it. That's what he sort of says. As I sort of, I'm struggling a little bit between those two bits of imagery.
Well, no, I think that's exactly right. I mean, Mark Rutte is right, and that is something I hear privately from people. In fact, the post-conference drinks, someone in NATO, very senior, said that to me. Look, there is no NATO without the US when we were asking if they've started to simulate anything, not factoring in the US turning up. I think where it is somewhat compatible, Geraldine, is that really the future of this NATO alliance is going to be the US providing the nuclear deterrence and the Europeans really arming up in a conventional way. These are the kinds of shifts that make NATO more Europe after Trump, but the US still present. At least that's the goal that Europe would like to achieve. I'm not so sure that the Americans share that goal, and I think it differs on who you talk to.
This type of shift, I just wonder, it might go down very well with people who are looking for leadership. This is obviously a changing story right now, is it?
Look, I think European politics is a whole another 20 episodes for us, Geraldine. I mean, the populism and the problems plaguing France, plaguing Germany as they rearm and try and struggle to find the budget to do both. This is not going away as an issue, and it is hugely problematic.
Okay. Well, look, let's go to some feedback. Here's an idea from Rosemary. In the light of all the reporting about the ongoing threat to Taiwan from China, while we occasionally hear about the repercussions for politically active Hong Kongers, how is life there generally? How much has changed for regular people? Are their thought police stealing people's feeling of freedom? What do they have to teach the world about the costs and benefits of avoiding a hideous world conflict? It seems to me that China can't afford to alienate the wider world from a mutual reliance trade point of view, though I realise they're working hard to form alliances with many non-first world countries. Thanks for your fabulous piece on Africa. It would be great if you did a piece on the current vibe in Hong Kong. She says, your inspiring show makes me feel less lonely as somebody addicted to ideas. I actually think that's a very good idea about Hong Kong. So thank you very much, Rosemary.
Yes, agree. I think that's a great, great shout. And from Lewis, Geraldine, global trust in the United States as a stable partner, let alone leader, has been shattered. It's time to broaden the discussion of options for relocating the UN outside of the US. Would love to hear what your team can dig up and produce on this topic.
Oh, my goodness.
There's an idea.
There's a tricky one. I tell you, the abstraction that would be involved in discussing that would be quite something, Lewis. We'll give it a go at some point. And finally, from Julia, I'm an Australian-American who spent 3 months volunteering in Bolivia last year. I recently checked in with Bolivian friends and colleagues to see how they're doing in the midst of current unrest and heard alarming accounts of food scarcity, anti-Indigenous racism and potential human rights violations, including the murders of community leaders at the hands of the military and police use of tear gas beatings and arrests against numerous protesters. Many of these details are not reaching the international community. Could you use your platform to collaborate with reporters who can share what is happening on the ground in Bolivia? Now, that is another interesting one. I mean, I noticed there's a very important election in Colombia at the moment too. Look, we will try. There's a lot to cover. Thanks so much indeed for all of these lovely, wide, far-reaching suggestions from you. We're just sort of always reminded of your broad taste, which is marvellous. Look, don't forget to write to us. We love your questions and feedback, as you can tell. Our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au. Are you back in London straight away, Latika?
No, heading back to Ukraine.
Ah, where are you going in Ukraine?
So Odessa, Zaporizhia, Mykolaiv, I think, but there's a Black Sea Security Forum at the end of the week, so I'll be joining a team to go and attend that.
Oh, marvellous. Gosh. Okay. Well, take care of yourself, and we'll see you next week.
See you, Geraldine.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.